Any questions about what we covered last time? So that was an approximation to electron-electron interactions, and called Hartree-Fock. And I indicated at the end that there was a problem with it, and the problem is something you're going to look at in this afternoon's tutorial, which is you're going to insert screening. And today, in the first part of the lecture at least, we will discuss what screening is and how it comes about. So I'm going to give a more physical derivation, I guess. We're going to imagine, again, fixing ourselves as one of the electrons. So as soon as we start doing that, we're thinking of a mean field approximation. That electron sees A, we're going to put, so here's the electron gas. We're going to put some test charge, Z, with charge ZE, in this electron gas. So the electron sees the external potential. So this is, in this case, a test charge. So it's a bit of a thought experiment. Well, it can be an actual impurity that you do this with, but for our purposes, it's a thought experiment. We're putting this there, and now some electron is going to see that and feel through the Coulomb interaction that external potential, but it will also feel an effect due to the other electron. So I'll call that V sub EE, and this is the other electrons. Okay, and then we're going to say that this is true for all the electrons. And then we're going to basically repeat, because we don't know what that interaction is, this V sub E. This we know. It's just you know, whatever it is in our thought experiment. But this we don't know. And it depends on what all the other electrons do that determines what this potential is as far as the one electron is concerned. So we have a potential then that consists of both of these contributions. And right away, just like we did with Hartree-Fock, we're writing this potential as a function of R now. So it's like an external potential as far as this one electron is concerned. Of course, that's not really true. Yes. Yeah.
I don't recall seeing a normalization constraint.
Well, at one point I wrote down a wave function which is 1 over the square root of V, which is the volume times the plane wave. So that was the normalization factor. I'm not going to worry too much about normalization today, because in the end we know they're all normalized. Does that answer your question? Okay. So we want to know what the we're going to treat this as a perturbation, and again we're going to consider the zeroth order wave function as simply a plane wave as we did before. I won't worry about 1 over root v's, and now we're going to want to calculate the perturbed wave function, which is this, let me call it psi, which is psi cave 1 is equal to e to the I, e to the I kr plus, I'll call it, their first order correction. Okay, and that's what we want to determine. Now, once we've determined that, then the electron density due to those electrons will simply be a sum over all the states of this thing squared. And since it's considered a perturbation, this will be sum over k times 1, because when we take the plane wave part and its complex conjugate, we'll just get 1 plus e to the I k dot r times psi k of 1 star plus e to the minus I k dot r times psi k of 1. And we'll stop there. We'll leave out the psi k of 1 squared because that's higher order in perturbation. The thing I left out here, though, and I'll put it in now, is that this sum is only over occupied states. So this is the Fermi function, and it's the finite temperature generalization of what it means to be in an occupied state. And so that also holds over on this side. Let me see where I want to go from here. So, but what is that psi k of 1? So perturbation theory tells us psi k of this correction is the sum over k prime of, basically, if I use ket notation, it's a matrix element of the perturbation with this energy denominator. And again, these are going to be these plane wave states. These are the unperturbed states. But I have to bear in mind that I can't just use any states. If I am an electron in this gas, then the unperturbed ground state, I guess I should have reminded you that the unperturbed ground state is this Fermi C of electrons. Okay, so all states inside this sphere are occupied, and all states outside are unoccupied. So when I'm doing perturbation theory in this mini-body system, and I'm including these excited states have to be available. And the ones inside the Fermi C are not available. They're occupied by other electrons. And so I have to put in this factor of 1 minus f of k prime. So normally I would just simply say, if this were zero temperature, I would say that epsilon prime had to be greater than EF. Okay, so they have to be states that are not occupied, that are available for excitation. But I want to sort of do this at finite temperature, and this is the same statement. Okay? And if I write this out in without the ket notation, this is just e to the I k prime dot r, and then this matrix element is just the Fourier transform of these potentials. And then I have 1 minus f of k prime. And this f of k prime is 1 over e to the beta epsilon k prime minus mu plus 1. So it's the Fermi-Dirac distribution function. So I plug that in here. And, well, the first term here is going to simply be n, the number of electrons in the system, plus, well, let me just call it delta n of r, where delta n of r is equal to the remaining part here, so it's a sum over k, f of k, and then if I substitute in what these things are, I get, and I also forgot a factor of 2, right? Because I should have written a factor of 2 here, because there are 2 spins. There's spin up and spin down. Okay? And so there's a factor of 2 here. N has that factor of 2. And now delta N r is equal to 2 times sum over k. And now I substitute in what these wave functions are from these perturbed wave functions from here. So I have a sum over k, k prime. 1 minus f of k prime is common to everything. And then I get e to the I k dot r, so I have an e to the I k minus k prime dot r. The minus k prime comes from the complex conjugate of this. And then I have this so-called perturbed potential. And then I have the complex conjugate of that. But I can just put a factor of 2, because if I make k go to minus k and k prime go to minus k prime in the complex conjugate, I just get the same thing. But when I write it in this form, well, if I write q equal to k minus k prime, then delta n of r is equal to 4 times the sum over q of e to the I q dot r times the sum over k of f of k 1 minus f of k plus q. So I put q equal, yeah, I set it there. Q is equal to, I'm going to write it as k prime minus k, so then k prime is q plus k. And this will be a minus sign there. And then I get e times v external of q plus v ee of q. When I write it like this, it looks like the transform of n of q and of delta n. So delta n of q is simply 4, and there's a 1 over, and I've left out, in fact, I left it out here as well, the epsilon k minus epsilon k prime, and here 2. So I end up with 4 over n times f of k 1 minus f of k plus q over epsilon k minus epsilon k plus q times e v external of q plus v ee of q. Okay? So I'd like to define now what's referred to as a susceptibility. Chi of q, and normally, yeah, I put in the fact that the 1 over n now, and there should have been a sum over k here. So I define this with a minus sign, with a factor of 2, and then sum over k, f of k 1 minus f of k plus q divided by this denominator. And if I use that definition, then delta n of q is going to be minus 2 times e times v external times this chi. Okay? Everybody okay with that? So what have I done here? I've derived a reaction of the electron density. So this delta NQ, if I've got this field present, then this potential is due to two things. One that I'm putting there, which is this external potential, and one that is a reaction of all the other electrons that I don't know, then I'm going to induce a charge fluctuation, a change in this n that would normally just be uniform, and it's going to have some r dependence, which in Fourier space, in wave vector space, is given by this expression. So it's just proportional to the potential, but there is this kind of response coefficient, if you like, that is a function of q. Now, that's not enough. So that's great. If I know this, then I know that. But I don't know all of this. I don't know what this is. And what will help me figure that out is Poisson's equations. And that tells me that that specifically for that change in charge distribution, that this is going to be minus 4 pi times E times this change in density. Okay, so if this were uniform, there was no change in electron density, there'd be no potential. But if it's not uniform, you can't just move charge around and then not induce a potential because of that movement of charge. So Poisson's equation tells you how that works. If there's a change in the charge distribution, then there's a potential induced, which is governed by Poisson's equation. Yeah?
What happens to the zero order n? Why is it not?
What happened to?
Why do I not have the zero order n?
This one here?
Yeah.
Because that's uniform, and that cancels with the uniform positive charge of the ions. That's from the Hartree approximation yesterday. So that's sort of neither here nor there. If that's homogeneous and it stayed homogeneous, then that'd be charge neutral and there'd be no inducement of a potential. it's only the change from that that's going to give rise to some extra potential, which is this thing that I claim was there, and we're trying to figure out what it is.
Yeah. Is the VE uniform before the perturbation?
This one?
VE.
This one?
Yeah.
Is it uniform?
Yeah.
No. No, we don't know what it is. We don't know what it is. So suppose I'm an electron here in the medium, right? So I'm just an electron right here. And now I bring in this test charge. What's going to happen? This electron is going to feel the test charge. But if I bring in a positive test charge into a sea of electrons, the rest of the electrons are going to move around and react to it, if they're allowed to. And since this is a metal, they're allowed to. They can move. You can't just bring in a test charge and expect that all the electrons will stay put. Is that clear to everybody? It's like, I don't know if you guys, you know, I was going to use this analogy last time, but I didn't think it was a great analogy, which is one that was used for the Higgs boson, and they essentially used the polaron analogy, and they said, okay, you're in, I think the one, they had a competition for this, right, who could come up with the best analogy, and someone mentioned something about the Queen or the Prime Minister of England walking into a room, and then people would congregate around that person. This is the same thing here, right? If we're in the vacuum, or if there's nobody else around and the Queen walks in, I see the Queen. I'm presumably attracted, right? Just like these electrons are attracted to the test charge. But if there's a whole bunch of other people in the room, then what happens as soon as the Queen walks in? They all rush to go see her. And then I don't see the Queen so easily. So my view of the Queen is screened. And that's what's happening here. That's what we're trying to describe with this algebra. Okay, and we're trying to, again, in analogy, you know, in principle, we're all interacting human beings, and we might fight one another on our way to getting to the Queen. Well, we leave that part out. That's too complicated. We're just looking at sort of on average what'll happen. What happens on average is a group will congregate around the Queen on average. So Poisson's equation governs that charge fluctuation, and you can just Fourier transform this, and you get minus Q squared VEE of Q is equal to minus 4 pi E. So if I put an E here, I get E squared delta N of Q. So this relates that induced charge to the induced potential. Okay, so this is key. So now delta N of Q is equal to V of Q times E V E of Q, where this delta N of Q, no, I want to write it the other way. So I'm going to define V of Q as 4 pi E squared over Q squared. That's the combination that shows up here. And now I can relate that induced potential that I don't know to the change in charge distribution. And the prefactor of that change in charge distribution happens to be the Fourier transform of the Coulomb potential. Well, now I can substitute in what delta N is over here. So if this is equation two, I substitute two into one, where one is this equation. And so I write that EVE of Q over V of Q, that's delta N, is equal to minus 2E V external of Q plus VEE of Q times chi of Q. Now, I'd rather keep these together for reasons that will become apparent in a minute. Like, in some sense, I really want to know what VEE is. But in another sense, I actually want to know what this combination is. Because this combination is what I'll call the effective potential. Right? Again, this one electron sitting out here naively sees this, but we know, or I've tried to convince you, that what it sees is the sum of these two. It sees the original disturbance, and it sees the disturbance created by the rest of the electrons. And that's what you would refer to as the effective potential that an electron sees. It's not just the bare test charge, it's also the reaction. So if I add and subtract, well, first the E's can go away. If I just add this external and subtract it, then I have this quantity, this V effective on both sides. So I write minus V external plus V effective, and I bring the V of Q up over there, is equal to minus 2 times V effective times chi. Which means that if I isolate what V effective is, then I get V effective is simply V external of Q divided by 1 plus 2, I brought the V of Q up, so I forgot to write it down, times V of Q times chi of Q. So let me write it in a slightly different way. Like this. So this is the dielectric function. And it's the static dielectric function. The more general version of this has both wave vector and frequency dependence. So frequency dependence because the way in which this electron reacts to the external test charge is going to be time dependent as well. We've ignored that. This is the static approximation. And epsilon of Q here is obviously just the remaining piece there. So now in some sense we can forget that we even dreamt up this thought experiment of bringing in this external charge. It almost doesn't matter. What this says is that for any kind of interaction of charge in this medium, there's going to be a modification because of the other electrons. Okay, is that, that's the big message here. And in particular, if this were just a number, if this number goes to one, then there is no modification. If the number goes to infinity, then there's such a huge amount of screening going on that the electron I'm fixed on doesn't see anything. The test charge is wiped out immediately by the other electrons. Those are two extremes. And for example, in semiconductors, very often this is replaced not only by a static approximation, but by actually just a number. They just indicate that the actual Coulomb potential has been reduced significantly. And furthermore, if I write this out, this is telling you that this susceptibility that I define governs everything. It's first of all, has nothing to do with the external potential that I introduced. And it has to do with the characteristics of the medium. It's telling you about the medium. How responsive is this medium to any kind of disturbance? And that's what this susceptibility tells you. If we look at, again, at what that susceptibility, what the expression is, it was minus 2 over n, just above here, f of epsilon k, if I write it out more fully, and let me separate this out. So let me write it as minus 1 over n, sum over k, f of epsilon k, 1 minus f of epsilon k plus q, times epsilon k minus epsilon k plus q. So that's only one of the terms. There's another identical term. Yep.
So for the V vector, you are saying that it measures the degree to which the Coulombic potential between the test charge and then the electron is modified due to the screening effect of the electrons.
Yes. That's what this does. And that does it through this. Yes, exactly. Yeah, so that probably didn't get recorded because your voices don't carry. But the question was asked, or it was just to confirm that the dielectric function epsilon or the susceptibility chi is tells you about the medium and how it responds to the introduction of a test charge and how it affects what potential any given electron in this medium sees, on average. So now I'm going to simply...
So if these two lines, one contains two, the other does
not. I have to finish this one, yes. So I have to add the same term, but what do I do here? I write k prime, I make the substitution, but k prime equals minus k plus q, that means k is minus k prime plus q. I make that substitution, and minus signs don't matter. Epsilon of minus k is epsilon of k. So I end up with this becomes k plus q now, k prime really, but then I change back the dummy variables, times 1 minus f of epsilon k. And then this becomes epsilon k plus q, and this becomes epsilon k. So I can keep it this the way it is, as long as I put a minus sign. And then this is simply equal to minus 1 over n, sum over k, f of epsilon k minus f of epsilon k plus q over epsilon k minus epsilon k plus q. Because those terms involving products of those functions cancel. And this is sometimes, I'll tell you right now that the chi of q and omega, if I kept the frequency dependence, and again, this is a two-particle Green function, so we have to put omega plus I delta. This is given by this expression. So it's in fact not that different. There's simply that omega in the denominator, omega plus I delta. And it looks like a propagator. It's hard for you to see from here, but it actually is a boson propagator, not a fermion propagator. And it's a boson because this susceptibility is actually a convolution of an electron and a hole propagator. So it's actually a product of two single particle Green's functions. If you take an electron in a hole, those are two fermions. Generally, when you combine two fermions, you get a boson, or what's known as a composite boson. Right? So if I ask you what helium is, what is helium atom, a boson or a fermion? It's a boson, but actually it isn't, right? It's two protons, two neutrons, and two electrons. Those are six fermions. But because it's an even number of fermions, for many intensive purposes, it behaves like a boson.
Well, there's also helium-3.
Yeah, I meant helium-4, sorry. I did mean helium-4, which, yeah. Yeah, helium-3, because it's an odd number of fermions, and it's effective, eh? Helium-4 is not truly a boson. It's a composite boson. And for the temperatures at which we do experiments here on Earth with helium-4, for all practical purposes, it's a boson. But in principle, you can kind of delve into it and figure out the fermion degrees of freedom, just like deep inelastic scattering can figure out the quark's degree of freedom in nuclei. Okay, but anyways, that's the origin of that form. So we get this expression, and this expression there's virtue in both kinds of these expressions. For example, in this expression, this tells you that you need a state k that is occupied. Remember, the Fermi function looks like this. Right, so f at zero temperature, it's really just a step function. F is 1 if it's occupied, 0 if it's unoccupied, and 1 minus f is 0 if it's occupied and 1 if it's unoccupied. So this says you need a product, you need the situation where k is occupied but k plus q is unoccupied. And that's the electron hole pair. A hole is an unoccupied state. On the other hand, if we use this expression, we could look, for example, very easily at the Q going to 0 limit. If we look at Q going to 0, then this is equal to minus 1 over n, sum over k, f of epsilon k, minus, and we simply have to expand this now, and we get Q dot, or we get f of epsilon k plus q dot the gradient of epsilon k times di f by di epsilon k plus blah, 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 higher order q. And then the denominator, you end up doing the same thing. plus da 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 da. And then these terms cancel, and the Q dot, the gradient actually cancels in both terms, and you're simply left with 1 over n, sum over k, of minus di f by di epsilon k. And that's about as far as we can go if we ask about what about t going to 0, then do you guys know what that is as t goes to 0? You know what it is when t is not 0? When t is not 0, it's a hyperbolic secant function. But when t goes to 0, have you ever dealt with this?
Well, apparently this was during the tutorial.
Oh, yeah. Well,
delta function.
This, what is f at t equals 0? F of theta of epsilon k is a theta function. It's a step side function with, normally I put mu there, but this is t going to 0. So it just says that for epsilon k less than EF, it's 1, understanding that epsilon k has to be greater than 0. And for epsilon k greater than EF, it's 0. But the derivative of a step side of a step is a delta function. So this goes down abruptly. It doesn't surprise you that that's a delta function. And it's a delta function with a negative sign, right? Because it's going down. So this is minus a delta function, but minus that is a plus a delta function. So it's 1 over n sum over k delta of epsilon minus epsilon f. And you know what that is. That's just the definition of the density of states. So when q goes to 0, the susceptibility, you view it as a constant, first of all, for all q. And you replace it by its q going to 0 value. Okay, so let's approximate chi of q as a constant whose value we've just determined, which is epsilon f. And now if I move that up, so if we do that, then the V effective of Q, which is up on the top there, is V external of Q over epsilon of Q, which is this 1 plus 2 V of Q chi of Q. Let's assume that there is an external test charge. Suppose we put an impurity into a metal, then, and it's a charged impurity, then this is simply 4 pi z e squared. Let's just take it, well, let's put the z. I like to put the z in there because this is to differentiate this from this little v of q that's in here. That little v of q is 4 pi e squared over q squared. Yes?
I have something that's been bugging me from the beginning.
Yeah.
What assumptions do we have about the electron-electron potential? Because when we solve Poisson's equation,
yeah,
even
delta n equals 0 would have non-trivial solutions unless we impose like some
boundary conditions. So if delta n is 0, then obviously there is a trivial solution of V being 0, VEE. But you're saying it could be a constant or something.
Or something else. Last question comes. That's a lot of solutions.
Yeah. I don't know. Okay, I don't know the answer offhand. Like the, you're saying if delta n is zero, I could get. I don't know. It's a three-dimensional equation, right? I've been sloppy. I've just been writing r as a variable, but it's a three-dimensional equation, right? So. I'm not sure that it's so easy to get other solutions. Anyways, I don't know the detailed answer to that at the moment. But it's certainly physically reasonable that if delta n of r is 0, VEE is 0, right? That's certainly a solution, and it's the correct solution physically. So whatever boundary conditions you have to put in to make sure you get that solution, that's what we have to do. You don't want to get a potential when there's no induced charge fluctuation.
Like the effective potential depends on the external potential and the electron-electron
yes.
potential.
It's the sum of the two.
Yeah, it's the sum of the two.
Yes.
So I really have no constraints in the external potential.
Right. You mean it doesn't have to be a certain potential. It's
yeah.
of your choosing, yes.
So, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what's that condition. There are no periodicity conditions or something like that?
No, and you know, in this, again, it's that picture that if you remember the first lecture, when I was showing lots of slides, I showed a slide of the surface of copper, right? And there were these little ripples in the charge density. That's exactly what comes out of this. And then the disturbance would be that entire surface,
yeah.
right? So. And it wouldn't be like I've drawn here in the middle of the whole gas. It could be any number of things. So it is quite general, what I'm trying to say here. So I think we'll move on. I don't know the answer to your question, but and this is just sort of a way of presenting it, right? We could go through the high-powered Feynman diagram expansion as well, because you know this is nothing other than the bubble, right? So you have a photon propagator, but then it comes along and polarizes the medium and gets modified. So if you like, this is equal to the bare one plus this, and actually plus an infinite series of these, right? And so on, right? Which is given basically by expanding this denominator into an infinite series. And it's very much, I don't know if you guys have done vacuum polarization, maybe in quantum field theory, but it's exactly the same thing. And these are electron hole pairs. There you have electron positron pairs. So it's the same idea. Okay, so we're going to assume this, And then assume chi of q is the constant. Then you end up with v effective of q is equal to 4 pi z e squared over q squared divided by 1 plus 8 pi e squared over q squared times. Now we substitute in that constant here. And when you work this out, you get 4 pi z e squared over q squared plus, well, let me write it out as q Thomas Fermi squared. This is exactly that potential that I used yesterday and that you're going to look at some more today in the tutorial, where q Thomas Fermi squared is simply this group of constants, 8 pi e squared times g of epsilon f. G of epsilon f is m over 2 pi h bar squared. So this is in 3D. Let me check that. This is 2 pi squared. All right, so if you remember e squared m over h bar squared is actually 1 over the Bohr radius, and that's the combination that's in there, so I get 4 qtf squared is 4 over pi times kf over a naught. But kf, what was it? N was equal to 3 over 4 pi rs cubed, but kf cubed was equal to 3 pi squared n. So kf cubed is 3 pi squared times 3 over 4 pi rs cubed. So kf is equal to 9 pi over 4 to the 1/3, 1 over rs. So if I go over, this is then qtf squared times a naught squared is 4 over pi, and I substitute that in, 9 pi over 4 to the 1/3 time divided by rs over a naught. So qtf a naught is the square root of that thing. Over the square root of rs over a naught. So again, the lower rs is, the higher the electron density. Okay, so and the higher the electron density, the more screening you expect. Okay, so the lower this is, the larger this value is, because there's more electrons around, there's more screening. And so this number is bigger, this qtf squared. OK, and the bigger that is, the more this is screened. As you know, the Fourier transform of that is the Yukawa potential. And so instead of having, seeing a potential that goes like 1 over r, you end up seeing a potential that decreases much more sharply, and it creates less of a disturbance in the electron gas. So this test charge should normally affect everything everywhere because it's long range. It's a Coulomb. But because of this medium, it actually becomes very short range. And that's the information that this afternoon you're feeding into the calculation to modify the Hartree-Fock that had this unphysical aspect, and now it will come out to be a lot more physical than just the bare Hartree-Fock. Let me see what else. There's one other thing I won't do. Well, I'll do it in one dimension, which is you can calculate this entire chi of q, in fact, chi of q and omega, if you wish, at zero temperature for the electron gas. And that's known as, it's when you do that, it's called the Linhart susceptibility. So in 3D, I'm not sure if you're doing this in one of the tutorials or not, but in 3D, the answer is chi of q is equal to g of epsilon f times f of x, where f is that same function that showed up in Hartree-Fock theory. Right? This was 1 half plus 1 minus x squared over 4x log of 1 plus x over 1 minus x. Except now, it's q over 2kf in the Hartree-Fock theory that showed up as k over kf. Now it's q over 2kf. Okay, so what was shown long ago in the early 60s was that if you plug this in to here now, so you don't make this approximation, you plug that into here, it's true that at as far as the short distance goes, it still looks like a screened Coulomb potential, but it's a lot more complicated now. But you plug that in and then you calculate this V effective for a Coulomb charge, but then you Fourier transform this and you ask, just like we mentally did it here, and we said this is the Yukawa potential, what will that transform to? So this leads to, so the answer is that for V of R much, much greater than A naught now, so this is V effective, it's actually going to look like cos 2kfr divided by r cubed. Okay, so it's not, at long distances, it's not screened out like the Yukawa. The Yukawa would be exponentially suppressed at long distances. It's only 1 over r cubed. But the important thing is it oscillates. Okay, and for you guys in, I don't know how, you've all seen it, but I don't know how much on the mind it is. Whenever you Fourier transform a step, what do you get? If you're engineers, you've done this a million times. Pardon? Yeah, but what do you get in general? Have you ever heard the expression Gibbs oscillations? So you get oscillations because you can't just can't transform a step that easily. To really get a step, you need an infinite number of Fourier components. So if you ever try it with a finite number, which is what they do in electronic engineering all the time, then you'll always get these oscillations that result. Here, there's no step, but remember, this function had a singularity in the derivative, the closest thing to a step you can get to. So it's that discontinuity, which ultimately, where is that discontinuity coming from? It's coming from the fact that back back in the Fermi C, there's a discontinuity. There's a Fermi energy. So there's an abrupt discontinuity. We're talking at T equals zero here. There's an abrupt discontinuity. There's, in other words, the notion that there's a Fermi surface ultimately leads to this oscillation. Why might we care about this oscillation? Because we are studying a gas of electrons. They repel one another. But this is saying that this, the effective potential that these electrons see amongst themselves, even if you don't put in an external test charge, but you just ask what is the effective potential they see amongst themselves, it will have this oscillatory behavior. And if I just plot that, so this is, and you know, it comes down like this, and then way out here, and I'd have to sort of magnify the scale because they're tiny oscillations, it goes up and down. But this means that in this repulsive gas, there are long distances over which two electrons will actually attract one another. In this place where there's a negative dip, there's actually an attraction. And so this led Cohn and Luttinger back in around 1960 to conjecture that every material, every metal, will become a superconductor if you lower the temperature enough. And it'll become a superconductor not necessarily with the S-wave symmetry, but with some high symmetry that takes advantage of high angular momentum. So not S state, but even higher, beyond P and D. That'll take advantage of these dips in the potential, which are attractive. And these are called, because these were first discovered by Friedel. They're called Friedel oscillations. He kind of figured it out theoretically. I think this actual behavior was done by Vasco a few years later, who was a professor down the road at University of Toronto. But they're referred to as Friedel oscillations, and they're the origin of those ripples that I showed you in that copper surface. Okay, we can quickly do a calculation in one dimension of chi of q, just to see how it goes. I guess I move this. So in 1D, chi of q is minus 1 over n sum over k of that thing. I want to write k prime. I want to do the substitution k prime is equal to k plus q over 2. So that means that k goes to k prime minus q over 2, and k plus q goes to k prime plus q over 2. Okay, so then I'll get f of, this was f of k, so it'll be k prime minus q over 2 times 1 minus f of k prime plus q over 2. And then it'll be divided by the energies. The energies are h bar squared over 2m. I got epsilon k, which is k prime minus q over 2 squared minus k prime plus q over 2 squared. So I did that substitution so that my denominator would simplify, because the k prime squared terms cancel, the q over 2 squared terms cancel, and all I'm left with is minus 2m over h bar squared times minus 2q times k prime, which I'll now put in. So a 2 pi comes over. And then I, this is in principle, this is from, in principle it's from minus pi to pi. But in practice, we're doing the free electron, so we're going to let it go to infinity. And we have the 1 over k prime. And now we have these Fermi functions. And the Fermi functions, this one says that k prime minus q over 2 squared has to be less than kf squared, right? Because if this is going to be 1, I'm doing t equals 0, then this has to be a state that's occupied, which means that this has to be less than kf. So this means that k prime is less than kf plus q over 2. If we think about the k prime, and this is 0, and this is kf, and this is minus kf, then this says that at some place, so this is kf minus kf, this says there's somewhere here it has to be less than this. All right? It also says that it could be equals q over 2. It could be greater than q over 2 minus kf, right? So minus q, so it could be greater than here if it's on that side. And I also have the other factor, which says that k prime plus q over 2 squared is greater than kf squared, which means k prime is greater than kf minus q over 2. So that means I have to integrate over that region. Or the other solution was that k prime is less than minus kf minus q over 2, which is this one. So this, I should have told you, I'm going to do q greater than 0 only. Okay, because chi of minus q is equal to chi of q. That's easy to show. And that's how I could draw these. If q is reversed, then this stuff here plays the role of that and vice versa. So that means that this integral is actually just from kf minus q over 2 to kf plus q over 2. And it's just a log. So I end up with m over 2 pi h bar squared I left out a 2 here. So there's a 2 here. So I'll put the 2, and then I'll put 1 over q over 2kf log of 1 plus q . So that's my result. And if I plot that versus q over 2kf, then if this is 1, I start here. You can show that this is where it starts is actually the density of states in one dimension. And I'm plotting it only for positive q because it's the same for negative q. And it actually diverges logarithmically at q equals 2kf. So in one dimension, the fluctuations are severe. The ability to respond is more severe than it is in higher dimensions. And that's generally true. That's why phase transitions are suppressed in lower dimensions. So in fact, right at q equals 2kF, this diverges. So right at q equals 2kF, the electron gas in one dimension is super responsive to screening out any kind of disturbance. If you do this in 2D, so in 2D, you will get a constant, and then it tails off. So it no longer diverges, but there's a big cusp there, right? Big discontinuity in the derivative right there. And then, so that's 2D. And in 3D, I told you what the answer was over there. It looks like this, and there's a diverging slope right there that gives rise to those Friedel oscillations. This is just for an electron, free electron gas. So this is a situation where if I just draw it in two dimensions, for example, the Fermi surface looks like a circle, or in three dimensions, it's a sphere. But remember, we talked about tight binding models. And in tight binding models, yeah, the Fermi surface looked like that when the filling was low. But as you continued to fill the Fermi sea, you added more and more electrons. Remember what happened to the two-dimensional tight binding model? The Fermi surface acquired this shape, which was this diamond. And there I mentioned the fact that, look, there's an entire bunch of states at the Fermi energy that are connected to another bunch of states just above the Fermi level over here by one wave vector, pi over a, pi over a. And sure enough, if you do the calculation of this susceptibility, but you do it for a tight binding model now, not the free electron gas, so you put in cosine dispersion curves, then, for example, in two dimensions, this susceptibility will diverge. So it'll be more severe because of this feature, which is referred to as nesting. The fact that one wave vector now connects an entire section of Fermi surface to another entire section of Fermi surface. Okay, that's all I was going to say about screening. And like I said, by incorporating screening into the Hartree-Fock calculation that we did yesterday that I just indicated to you had lots of defects, you're going to fix those defects because it's physically relevant and important to getting physically correct answers. Any questions about what we've covered here? So I'm now going to move on to, and we could delve in a lot more detail for a lot of aspects here, but I do want to cover a bit of magnetism, and then I want to cover superconductivity. So on the side of magnetism, there are three chapters in Ashcroft and Merman, for example. There's chapter 31, 32, and 33. 31, I'm basically going to skip. I want to tell you about two or three items which are more in the category of jargon. One is the magnetization. So you just have to know that the magnetization as a function of magnetic field, and this is the magnetization density, I guess, minus 1 over V, so that's a definition, basically. And this is T equals 0. So T equals 0, this is the ground state energy. And this is saying that if you turn on a magnetic field and the energy wants to go up, that's bad, right? That hurts you. And that means this derivative is positive. And so negative M is, we'll just say bad in quotes, and that is referred to as diamagnetism. Okay, it's opposed to magnetism, right? Because it raises the energy. Whereas a positive M is good, in quotes, and that refers to paramagnetism. And I also want to say one more thing, which is if you've got a B field or an H field like this, then I'm going to do this in the lecture, so I'm a little... So if that's a spin, then when the spin aligns with the magnetic field, which is normally what you think of as correct, this is actually higher energy. And when the spin is opposed to the magnetic field, that is the low energy solution. But if we're talking about moments, and this is like lowercase n, which which I don't really have here, but it's basically minus g mu b s, where mu b is the Bohr magneton, then for moments, when it's a, this one is opposed, and this one is aligned with the field. So what I'm saying is that what you've probably learned and what I learned is that it's favorable when these things align with the field. That applies to the moment, not the spin. But a lot of people forget about, so the minus sign is a remnant from Benjamin Franklin, who decided to make the electron have negative charge, right? He should have made it positive, because we put all our currents in the positive direction, and that influences how our magnetic moments are defined. And if the electron had been defined with the positive charge, there wouldn't be this confusion. But even Ashcroft and Merman, at some point, they give up on this, and they just talk about the spin being aligned as being the lower energy state. Okay, and they don't worry about the minus sign. So just don't get confused when you see statements that look a little odd. They basically define a moment that ends up being, doesn't have a minus sign. Normally, or fundamentally, the situation is this. When the spin is aligned, that's the bad state, that's higher energy. And it's when the moment is aligned, that's a good state, which corresponds to the downspin. But like I said, that convention is not followed very often. Okay, so I'm skipping all of chapter 31. Chapter 31 is basically about the constituents. It's like we, in condensed matter in general, we spend some time studying the electrons. That's one of the constituents. And as far as I'm concerned, the other sort of constituent is the phonon. Those are the basic constituents of any system, in the sense that they, at least in the harmonic approximation for the phonons, they can be solved for, and as long as they're not interacting, we can characterize what they look like. You can do the same thing with atomic moments, and that's what chapter 31 delves into. And then at the end of chapter 21, they go to the other case where what if the moments are moving around? So they're attached to itinerant electrons that are conducting, and they look at Pauli paramagnetism. So chapter 31 basically gives you, it talks a little bit about diamagnetism. It says there's a thing called Curie magnetism in any insulator that's not closed shell. If it's closed shell, like the noble gases, then you get diamagnetism. But if it's not closed shell, you get that the susceptibility, and the susceptibility is simply, so this is the magnetic susceptibility, is di m by di h. So it's the response of the magnetic moment to a field. So, and this is not the susceptibility we've been talking about over there. This is a magnetic susceptibility. And in the case of metals, you get Pauli paramagnetism, which is basically a constant. Because in a metal, you've got this whole Fermi C that's filled, so you can't just do excitations down to any low temperature. You're eventually cut off because K Boltzmann TF plays the role of a cutoff energy at low energies. So we're going to skip right to interactions. And when it comes to interactions, let me write it down. Magnetic interactions are fake. There, I said it. I feel like a professor I had in first year engineering who was teaching electricity and magnetism. And one of the things he declared with very emphatically is that delta functions are a fraud. He refused to have delta functions discussed in his classroom. Didn't want anything to do with them because he felt they were a fraud. This is a little different. Does anybody understand what this statement means? Has anybody ever heard this statement? You have? Where?
I don't know if you, do you mean that like magnetism is a result of electrostatics and special relativity?
Yes. Yeah. Well, primarily electrostatics, right? That's because there are magnetic interactions, right? There's the dipole-dipole. So U, the potential between two dipoles is given by this expression. And that's not fake, that's real. And it says, for example, if you have anti-alignment, in other words, if you have this situation or this situation, what is that energy? That energy is, you get a minus sign from here, but you get zero from here. So you basically get minus m squared over r cubed. On the other hand, if you have ferro alignment, which I'll draw like this, or like this, not the other kind, not the vertical one, but if you have it like this, then this gives you a 1, but this gives you a -3, so you get -2 m squared over r cubed. And so you look at this and you say, great, then what are you talking about fake interactions? This works. You'll get ferromagnetism preferred over antiferromagnetism, and you'll get alignment like this. The trouble is when you put in the actual numbers here, this typical value of U for typical values of spacing of these moments, say in insulators, is 1 degree Kelvin. Okay, and the ferromagnets we know, like iron, nickel, so on, the Curie temperatures, where they order, are of the order, you know, more like 1,000 degrees Kelvin. So these actually play a huge role. I shouldn't downplay the role played by a dipole-dipole interaction. They end up governing all the domain formation and that stuff that goes on. But as far as the actual alignment, how you get ferromagnetism or antiferromagnetism for that matter at these elevated temperatures, it does not come from this interaction. It comes from the good old Coulomb interaction. And that's what I'm going to talk about on Monday, how you end up getting magnetism out of electrostatic interactions. Okay? And then it's in that sense that magnetic interactions, I say magnetic interactions are fake. Okay, we're going to stop here and we'll see you on Monday. Have a good weekend.